been over a decade since Commonwell launched with the goal of making interoperability ubiquitous. TEFCA went live in 2023, and information blocking enforcement finally has teeth as of September 2025. So where does that leave us? My guest, Paul Wilder, has been in health IT since before interoperability became a national priority, from helping 10,000 providers test a meaningful use in New York to leading Commonwell as it became a TEFCA QHIN and beyond. This episode takes stock of where interoperability actually stands in late 2025, what's working, what's still broken, and what the next chapter holds for policy and implementation. This is The Policy Stack. I'm Lisa Berry, and welcome, Paul.
Great to be here. Thank you very much.
So, Paul, why don't you just briefly introduce your background and how you got to where you are today in interoperability and policy and implementation?
Yeah, it's probably no surprise because many of us have the same answer. I kind of fell into it similarly by accident. Started out in IT doing general help desk type stuff and wound up with a healthcare company very quickly after quitting my first job in 5 months, because that's what people out of college do, I guess, because they don't really see what a career really is. And I quickly moved over to document management, so health record management, pre-EHRs. This is really sending around PDFs and TIFF files to sign off. Then to radiology, cardiology imaging, which interestingly enough is probably the first technology or any kind of subset of healthcare to go digital very fast and move from analog to digital in really years, not decades. Now there was a little bit more of a standard impetus to get there. Like literally you had a file room that was taking up space where you could put in a device that did more radiology stuff, and the chemicals were caustic. And there was a lot of reasons why it was better to go to a digital format. So it went a little bit faster, but that kind of led to where I wound up, which is EHRs, analog to digital transformation, and then interop was a natural extension of that for me.
That's great. And so, you know, I want to get to the main question around the state of interoperability, but I think both of us share the background of working in the earlier meaningful use days. So let's talk really briefly about, you know, what actually happened between the policy and the implementation, right? Their policy impetus was to accelerate the adoption of electronic health records. Meaningful use didn't invent health IT, so to speak. There were already health IT systems. There was already some health IT adoption. What was different about meaningful use from policy to implementation?
Yeah, people who know me know I always say that I cheat. Like I try and find the easy way to get to a large result. And in the regional extension centers weren't really any different in that. The first thing we did was go after people who already had started or were already along the way for adoption of an EHR, but needed help using it correctly. Right, so to use it, to use the term meaningfully, which I guess was in the act. So I don't think it actually moved the primary care, at least where I was in New York, helping the 5,000 to 10,000 providers move. We have pretty decent ambulatory adoption in the primary care space. We helped, now the regional centers didn't allow us to work with specialties. So we actually petitioned that certain ologies after primary care should be considered primary care, because once you're in their office, they're your primary care physician. Like you could argue oncology is a primary care physician once you're diagnosed with cancer. Like it's just, they just are until you're kicked back into normal primary care. So we got a couple exceptions there, but I think what you really saw was a big movement on the inpatient side. And the big change was from having multiple systems where, you know, dermatology got something and the ex-ology got another, to monolithic systems that were a combination of all the clinicals and all the practice management stuff you would do in one solution. So I think we saw a big shift in the inpatient side, which went along with, of course, what was going on in the ambulatory as well.
Yeah, definitely. And just to be clear, the New York Health Collaborative both today serves as the coordinator for statewide health information exchange in New York, but also had served as the regional extension center trying to help those primary care practices in the state move forward on meaningful use.
Yeah, New York actually had two regional extension centers that had one based in the city that did just the, you know, the five boroughs. And so I ran the one that did everything outside the five boroughs. So, you know, Rochester, Buffalo, Long Island, all across the state, did a lot of driving.
Yes.
So you can fly too, but it's almost less efficient to just drive to Rochester. It's a 4-hour drive. Enjoy.
But exactly. It was a lot of fun, and actually. And that meaningful use, the word meaningful, oft pilloried by the community involved, because, of course, You have a policy, you write down specific objectives, and then it meets reality and implementation. And it can be it was quite tricky to get people to truly find value. I think you were previously talking about not promising frontline providers that they would be able to do their work more quickly, and that's a reality of adopting electronic health records at the time.
That's 100% true. I think a fair amount of my onstage speeches were like a therapy session. For those of you who started, you've slowed down. We understand. For those of you who are about to start, yes, it's true. So you kind of, I've always been a truth in marketing person. Tell them the truth and then lead them towards where the promise might be. And what we found was what hit home to a lot was you are not recording the complications of your patients very well. And you're not getting credit for it. It's very hard to bill for a thing you don't have evidence of a disease state. So, procedures and diagnoses need to go together. So you can defend an audit. So there, you can reduce risk. You could probably increase the revenue you're getting because you can now put things in that you can justify as opposed to a yellow sticky note from a nurse or a doctor that's put on a chart in the front and one day disappears. And an audit, you're like, I actually don't have a record of why I did that. And you get it re you're removed from, revenue gets removed and potentially gets sanctioned. So it was a safer way of doing healthcare on the financial side and better for the record keeping as well.
Right. I think you're leading towards an important point, which is this combination of clinical and financial systems being a driver towards this corporate adoption of electronic medical records. I think it leads us into the topic of interoperability in an important way, because of course, exchanging data for clinical or financial purposes wasn't invented in the last couple of years. There's been lots and lots of exchange of data, whether it's claims data or other types of financial data or clinical data. But really, the impetus for that exchange was primarily in sort of the private, there is a business context. We have to do this for the purposes of achieving some kind of common or connected financial goal. And so, with the sort of getting us to where we are in interoperability, some things happen now also over a decade ago, or almost a decade ago, on the legislative side and on the regulatory side to kind of bring that floor up on interoperability. So let's talk about where we actually are now in late 2025. What is the state of interoperability, Paul? Like, where are we right now?
And this will be no surprise to yourself and probably many that are listening to this podcast. The treatment side is going pretty well, right? I think we have large volume exchange of treatment. I will say usage is not as good as you would like to see it. I think we're still lacking the tools to analyze, decipher, normalize, do all the things you need to do with someone else's data that you didn't create yourself and isn't on the same normalcy that you expect, right? Because everybody records things different. I think that's changing a fair amount with AI and the ability to sift through this stuff much faster without having to actually manually do things. They do take your best shot and give me a summary, right? You get a large 20-page policy document. What do you do now? You say, give me a 3-paragraph summary and I'll read it later. And then whether you read it or not later is a whole different question. So the treatment side is working pretty well. I think the tools are advancing very quickly. I think in the other lanes, so we start talking what I usually call the crossing of the P's, provider to payer, provider to public health, provider to patient, and then any of those other P's crossing with each other, things get a lot trickier and really nowhere near as advanced as you'd want them to be. You look at provider to patient, I think there's a lot of momentum right now to say patients should get access to data and they can manage their health and all that stuff. I know that the number of transactions happening right now is in the hundreds per month over here,
Right.
and it's in the hundreds of millions for the treatment side, right? It's a big, big difference in terms of how much is happening.
It's a huge difference. And I think, a lot of the public debate and the public discussion is around patients should be able to access their data. I don't think you or I would ever say anything against that. We agree 100%. Personally, as a patient, obviously, I want to access and use all of my own data. But reality is that it is a tiny, tiny fraction of the exchange happening because of the business-to-business nature of a huge amount of healthcare technology and healthcare data in general. So I just it's a really interesting dichotomy of what the public picks up on, what journalists who write about the industry pick up on, versus what's actually happening out there. Just like in any other industry, there's a huge amount of data being exchanged for those business-to-business purposes, which is hard to hear or think about if you're a patient who isn't involved in healthcare technology and doesn't know all the pieces that have to move to make healthcare operations happen, so to speak. It's a really interesting dichotomy right now.
Oh, it's crazy. And I think, there is a critique or I don't know, philosophy that patients won't know what to do with their data. And so why give it to them? I think that may actually be true, right? I don't think they know what to do with the data. I just don't think that's a good enough reason not to give it to them. Like, let's see if they can figure it out, right? Because maybe we need them to help us bend the quality cost curve. I'll give you the primary use that I think every patient should be aware of upfront right now, and every provider should admit to as well. They make a boatload of mistakes. And if on my credit card someone was buying TVs that I didn't buy, because because that's a mistake, right? It's not, I didn't do it. Somehow someone let out my credit card number because it's in my wallet still. I don't know who did that. Someone made a mistake and I can correct it. And how could you be in charge of making sure your data is right? Who cares more than I do about that if I can't see it, right? And so I think that is the first use we should all embrace of help us correct the data. And I'll go back and bring up a term I don't like to use often, but I've already used it once today, which is AI. The future AIs will not work well with data that's wrong. Like they have contraindications. They see a conflict of one piece of data and another. It throws it into a loop. It starts making stuff up, or it skips over really good therapies because it says this doesn't go with this, but I never had this. Well, I didn't, the data doesn't show that. I could have cut that out. Like, I always use example where there's some wonder prostate drug and I have advanced prostate cancer when I'm 80, and it says it's contraindicated to the HPV vaccination, which I've never had, but apparently is in my record when I got a flu vaccination. I'm not saying I shouldn't have gotten the HPV vaccination, but I didn't get it, right? So you got to be really careful. There's a ton of errors, and once you start getting it, you start to see how many there are. I'm not faulting anybody. It's just it takes a village. You got to look at your stuff.
Well, I think patients won't know what to do with their data because the data aren't designed for patients, right? They're data that are designed for business-to-business transactions. They're about the patient. I think, like you just said, I'm hesitant to recommend this, but certainly a patient can take clinical notes, medical records, and put them into an AI and get some kind of interpretation based on the training of those data in the past. Now, is it particularly safe? Is it free of errors? Are there not? Of course, there are issues with that, but increasingly, there will be tools for patients to understand the business-to-business health data that is about them, but not meant for them. And so I think just again, going back to what we actually do, what you and I do from a work perspective, is we're primarily involved in that data business-to-business healthcare data transfer, exchange, interoperability. But I think a lot of the public conversation on policy is about patients accessing their data. We agree patients should access their data, but the work that actually we're involved in from a policy implementation side, what most of the industry is involved in, is truly this business-to-business thing. Now, you mentioned treatment. There's obviously payment operations, there's public health, there's benefits determination, there's so many other use cases. And you said, and I think it's a good framing of the magnitude or the volume, hundreds for patients and hundreds of thousands, millions plus, billions around treatment if you look at the bigger exchanges. And the other stuff, the payment and operations, where are we there? Not far is what I would surmise.
Well, I'll partially disagree. I'll say over the networks, it's very, very far away, I think. But what I'm seeing is every time I start talking about operations exchange over a network, I actually wind up connecting a payer source and an EHR type source together, and they start working it out. So we're creating this like demand creation of, you can do this. And without a specific example, I was talking to a payer. They're like, what data sources do you have that you can get to us? I was like, well, it's from XYZ vendors. The next week I talked to them, it's like, yeah, we talked to those vendors and we're working with them right now. I was like, I'm not providing, and I can't do it cheaper than they can, right? Like, say, and let's do the theoretical dollar. Say they charge a dollar. For me to also have the risk and the legal and all the stuff on top, I'm gonna have to charge some margin on that, even if it's 5 cents. So it's $1.05. When you start doing hundreds of thousands of transactions, 5 cents, and you start doing millions, it starts to matter. So why wouldn't you go direct versus coming to me? So we're starting to stratify this as the big payers and the big EHRs are definitely going to communicate themselves directly. There's no reason for me to be in the way of that. I think the networks have a shot at solving the long tail problem, right? There's more payers than we realize. It's not just United, Humana, and a bunch of Blues, and like there's hundreds. And you have Medicaid plans for every county in New York State, like they're small. What happens when the Orange County Medicaid plan needs to get data from Indiana University Health, where they're never going to establish a relationship with them? They need a way to transact that somewhere. You need a clearance network. So if you start thinking of the networks as a long tail clearance thing, it starts to make sense, but it doesn't make sense to happen now. The big guys have to finish, the mediums have to get started, and then we can maybe get rid of the fax. I do not think I'm going to get great success in getting two small things to interact over here against in a network with two parties who never get to talk to each other, right? There's a whole bunch of things that happen when they talk to each other directly, indemnification, legal stuff. All this thing gets put into that contract. It's not just a data exchange and it's not just a cost, right? So I think we're the long tail at the end, and it's not now.
You're talking about an important thing, which is the concept of the semi-open, semi-public network, connecting many to many under a common governance framework, common technical framework in many cases, versus these point-to-point connections that we know are already happening for all kinds of business-to-business exchange and healthcare, right? And as you said, these are large EHRs, large payers, large healthcare institutions, where it might make sense for them to have a direct connection because the volume is so high. The thing about the open slash semi-public, public good kind of networks out there is that you need that kind of investment to have to allow the smaller players to work together. So there's then a question about the financial sustainability of these open and semi-public networks. They also can theoretically unlock innovation, right? Innovative technology partners could also connect over them, or smaller EHRs, or newer EHRs, or newer systems of record. And so it's a little bit of a, like, I don't know, is it like becomes like a bit of a tragedy of the commons if we don't invest in these semi-public networks? There's really a dichotomy here. Like, the big guys win and exchange data no matter what. What about everybody else?
Yeah, so I don't see it that way. So first of all, let me be clear on something if I overstate this. Not that we're not working on it. I just know that I'm not going to see fruits for it for a long time. So we're not going, I'm not having a conversation with my board that the sustainability of Commonwealth is dependent upon provider to payer exchange, right? And I think that there are some of our competitors or cooperators, wherever you look at this, because we're kind of in this TEFCA soup or care quality soup together, that are building business models around solving that different P exchange, the provider to payer exchange. And I'm like, if that's your business model, I don't know if you're going to make it, right? Because it's going to take a while, and I hope you have deep pockets of investment. We look at it as we'll be sustainable on treatment, and we'll add that on because it's the right thing to do, and it's helpful for both the provider and the payer side. And we'll find things in the middle that are obvious, like take electronic prior authorization. That should be over a network, right? Because one of the things that is not well understood in EPA is some of the data you need to approve really expensive, complicated drugs or therapies requires a response from multiple participants. It's not from the prescriber, it's from the prescriber and the three other specialists that help justify, my Dupixent thing that I put into my body every 2 weeks with, my own syringe at home. That's an expensive therapy and needed data from my ophthalmologist, my ENT, and my pulmonologist to prove that I need this thing, because I couldn't do steroids because then I was going blind in my left eye and likely my right. So I have to get off steroids or I'm going to have an asthma attack, be back in the hospital. These are three different ologies that had to coordinate on things that they don't understand. If you talk to a pulmonologist about an eye, they say, I blanked out on that part in my residency. I don't remember a darn
I don't
thing about
remember
it.
that part of medical school.
Right? They don't. And so they're specialized. They don't. So you have,
Right.
and by the way, you talk about that patient data thing. I had to be an advocate to put those pieces together, right? So, like my pulmonologist is like, well, we really should get you on like a biological instead of these steroids if you're having these problems. I said, like, ooh, I can help get that stuff together. I know how to do it. And I have advantage there that I could help create that story. But That is an example of something that a network would help because the prescriber can talk to the payer directly. Actually, they don't today. They use these web trap forms. They're uploading data to a web thing. The payer's getting it from the web thing, put in an algorithm. It's ridiculous. It's like a trap fax thing in the middle. But they actually need a more complete record with more data elements to prove this thing. And fortunately, I had a pulmonologist who was very nice who collected it all for me, right? Said, I'll get all that stuff because I really want you to have this drug and you'll be a better controlled asthma patient. So anyway, a long story is I think there are things that, and by the way, that's one that could probably go to free, right? Part of the operations problem is people are charging for records because who's benefiting financially when they get it isn't always the thing that revealed it. So there's a balance and there's technology and all that stuff. This is one that has a mutual benefit because, you know, there's the payers are spending a lot of money administratively doing prior authorization. They often deny things, but the provider side would say, I'd rather have a denial in 5 seconds so I can start managing what to do than to have it come back 5 days later when I've already sent the patient home. And I'm like, I'm sorry, it didn't get approved. Now we have to start an appeals process. So I think we're all aligned on this one. And networks could help there. But some of these things, the point to point is actually more appropriate. Sorry, that was a very long
Well,
answer for a short point.
I agree with you on e prior auth. I think that is there's enough alignment. There's also enough. It also affects patients enough, right? It affects the people who are receiving care enough. I have a similar story to you, right? With my expensive eye drops. You know, same story, same human in the middle, me who's trying to coordinate all the different specialists and the pharmacy and the specialty pharma, you name it. So I think a lot of people can relate to that. And also importantly, it has a point of alignment from a business perspective. I think that's where some of these ambitions from national and federal approaches fall apart. It's like you're missing that point of alignment. And I think just, to give credit where credit is due, I think there is a lot of focus right now in the administration around e-prior auth because it has been identified after so many years of us pushing, pushing the boulder up the hill, Sisyphus, and trying to find those points of where is there actual alignment between all the stakeholders to make this thing better. Let's talk a little bit about TEFCA, which obviously was pushed a lot by the prior administration, lots of focus, and I would argue a lot of policy without implementation. Like, where are we right now? Commonwealth is the TEFCA QHIN is part of this process. There's a bunch of governance stuff happening. Like, where is it today? It's not being talked about as much by the current administration, and with the current government shutdown as well, there's even fewer communications.
I'd say, first of all, a lot of the treatment volume that we did in other frameworks or networks both have started to shift there. But the one thing that's making it not look like that is we are still connected to other things, right? And so take the common infrastructure. I wouldn't say it's unique, but there are some that don't operate the way we do. All of our vendor members, so Oracle, Athena, Greenway, they connect to us. They then create kind of a network inside that fans out to all their providers. That's how we can have these 20 some odd thousand connections at a company run with four people, right? Because it's really a network of network, and then there's a big spider in. Now, by the way, we're not the four people doing the technological stuff. We do have a service provider that helps with a lot of that. You know, I promise we don't have only four developers here and just me.
Governance layer. Governance layer
Yes,
is four people.
we are a governance layer. That's right. And
Yes.
so we, our network then connects to other frameworks and networks because we recognize not every vendor in the country is going to join Commonwealth. We think that would be great, but you know, let's assume that's not going to happen to do ubiquitous access. And so we're connected to Care Quality, kind of a previous, almost like a predecessor to TEFCA in some way, shape, or form, the way it's structured. And we're connected to TEFCA. We can send data bound down either path. For a while, we were going down the care quality path. If something existed in both places, send it down care quality because that's the one we're used to. We only just shifted. If it's in both, send it down the TEFCA path, right? And right now, though, the Venn diagram intersection shows only about 25% of the stuff available in care quality is available in TEFCA. So even if you were to measure it, like it looks like it's only a quarter of the way. Well, yes, that's right, because that's where it is. That's just a fact. Like we don't have Oracle connected to TEFCA yet. They're coming. They're going to be their own queue, and they should be designated in weeks or, well, I guess they can't during furlough because the ASTP can't designate them. But they're, you know, that's going to happen soon, and then they'll start
Theoretically
putting
in
their things in,
progress.
theoretically in progress. So I think there is more that you can't see, partially because the other things are still being used as a default condition. We just changed our default. Epic's changing their default. You're going to start to see those numbers go up fairly substantially. Now, on the other side, though, if you go on the crossing of the P's and the idea that TEPCA was a fresh start to not lock ourselves into being treatment only, we look a lot treatment only right now. To be honest, right? That I don't think that part's fixed. I think the agency of ASTP and the attachment to CMS has the opportunity to help that, but so far that's slow, like very slow.
Yeah, definitely. What do you think will start to move that? I know, we've been aware of some actions. Obviously, we talked in the opening here about the beginning of enforcement for no information blocking rules, which was announced by HHS OIG, Office of the Inspector General, in partnership with ASDP ONC, which is the agency home in HHS for the for TEFCA and for the no information blocking rules and for the certification program and all the pieces around that. Do you see, how did you feel about that announcement, Paul? And what did you take from it? Have you seen anything change at all around information blocking so far?
Fortunately, no, not well, that's not true. In the marketplace, yes. Here, no, right? Because I don't think we're designed to be blockers. So if I said, are you afraid? I'm like, we've been for data
No,
sharing
we
from the
share
beginning.
information.
So look somewhere else. Like if you're thinking you're gonna make a claim, talk to me because I think you're misunderstanding something. So for our perspective, no. I have seen though, like you saw information blocking. You also saw TEFCA bundling as a concern of EHRs that had their own queue in that they didn't have a path for other stuff. I think that shook up. That's like a very inside baseball kind of policy guidance thing that doesn't really resonate with most people. But that had an effect on the way the EHRs were thinking about their connectivity and any quasi-blocking behavior that they were doing in the guise of making their products work better. Right, I think there
Yeah.
was
So
a
right.
legitimate concern
You
there.
guys, HIEs are named in the law as potential actors in information blocking, but as you said, HIEs are primarily designed to share information. So maybe it's a concern or a misunderstanding of how to engage with EHA, how to connect. EHRs also obviously named as information blockers. And what you're talking about, that's the inside baseball, is a misunderstanding of whether an EHR can require a particular customer to connect to their QHIN or their HIE versus any QHIN or any HIE. And like, I agree with you. I do think it's a bit inside baseball, but clearly policy guidance that was directed at EHRs in this long drawn out implementation process for TEFCA. So it'll be interesting to see if that actually changes any behavior. I do think that the message was received, though. That's my interpretation.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, though, it's like some products will not work as well if you use a different QN. That actually is true, right? So I do think the vendors, and I have one that has thousands of connections. Like, well, if they use it, we'll hook them up. But when I hook them up that path, it's through our kind of HIE interop path, which isn't it doesn't automatically do things like clinical decision support. It doesn't take data from the outside and automatically do contraindication. Doesn't help with moving reconciliation of diagnoses and procedures. Like it's not as embedded. So like yes, you can, but now they just have to kind of say, but I can make you aware, but if you want to do it anyway, I have to let you do it. Well, I think before they were like emphatic, where your SLAs are broken, you can't do this or that. Like no. The thing is still going to work. It's just not going to work as clinically well as they've designed it. But maybe you like the HIE and the way that it mashes up data differently than the way the EHR does. And you're like, no, it's actually, this is a better path for me. You can't get in the way anymore. And we saw legitimate cases of that where they were connected to both like eHealth Exchange and to something else. And they're like, we'd like to use eHealth Exchange as our QN. And they're like, well, you can't because all this stuff is broken. So, well, I can, I'm already connected. And I'm cool with that. And they're like, okay, I guess this policy matters now.
Well,
It was crazy.
I think it's also that there hasn't been, we haven't seen a lot of the differentiation yet. It hasn't been made clear to the market, right? If multiple HIEs or multiple EHRs or whomever else runs an HIE of any type are QHINs and they're connecting under a common framework, a common governance framework, and with some common technical standards, well, what's the differentiation? Why would it be part of your QHIN versus somebody else's QHIN? I don't think that differentiation has yet really filtered through the market and maybe even filtered to policy. I don't think policymakers know how to consider those differences or where QHINs can quote unquote compete with each other. They talked about it at a high level early on, but we haven't really seen that. Like, why Commonwealth's QHIN? Give me your QHIN pitch, Paul.
Stability, maturity, and scale, right? It's actually very, very, very simple. And then, of course, when we get into the weeds, you start to learn about the NPI and the way we do patient matching around the country. Scale allows you to do the finding of patient data easier, faster, better, cheaper. If you're small, it's harder. And I'm not discouraging people from being QHINs to give it a shot. But we found the scale matters. And you asked a question, kind of, some obvious, what's going on? I will say the one thing that we've seen change, and this happened really, we saw this in the last 3 months, the acceleration of smaller vendors coming in and starting to connect has really started. We've had, I think, 20 new members this year. And I think last year we had 55 total. So that's a lot. Like we're mature and have kind of the big market share guys, except for Epic and eClinical Works, I guess, and NextGen, I guess we weren't really on the list. The top seven of the top 10 market share things. We're always considered like top heavy. But we're really seeing a lot of the earlier entrants come in and say, we really got to get moving. But I think that's good. For others, no MPI, no scale, gonna be harder, quite frankly. And the policy and governance to be able to do that. It's actually hard to govern a nationwide MPI. Because there's a lot of
For sure.
constituents who want to tell you how to run it. And you have to, one, be an expert, and two, prove why they should listen to you. And that takes time.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the interesting things about Commonwealth from the beginning was, of course, vendors or partners, technology partners who compete in the market against each other in many cases, but are trying to cooperate on interoperability. That was kind of the original things around the creation and the development of these national networks. Any sort of lessons you can share from navigating that competition, cooperation, coopetition landscape?
The hardest thing we find here, first of all, yeah, that's true, right? And I think we've talked to before, the analogy is kind of like a sports thing, right? The NFL, if the team suck, the NFL sucks, but the NFL sucks, the teams don't have a thing to go out there and organize and play against each other every Sunday. Well, now it's every Thursday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. That's a lot of days they play now. So we see it as kind of like this franchise model. We run the rules in the middle. They all fight as with their teams out in the marketplace and do their thing. But when we meet together, we do have kind of a leave your badge at the door policy. It's not even a policy, it's a philosophy, it's a culture. We had a summit a month ago, and it's a very strange conference. I can't even call it a conference. It's definitely a summit. Like it's a practical understanding of what's going on in the alliance. And you'll see EHR vendors telling other ones on a stage exactly how they integrate stuff because they don't see it as like something they should hold as a competitive advantage because it needs to work everywhere. Like, we culturally believe that interop should not be a single vendor solution and it can't be done by one entity. So we help them do that. And so I think that's great. The bad news is sometimes the things you say you will do are not what you actually do. So you could have a meeting of the brightest people from the company and all come to the solution that you got to do X, Y, and Z. They bring it back to their company and then they don't do X and they partially do Z and Y they completely forgot about. So it's hard to get universal acceptance of these new use cases and these new crossing of the P's. Knowing that the people who, with good hearts and minds, are working together aren't always the people that decide where the product is really going to go. And that's an internal discussion. And we have that at the board too. Like, when you've been on boards and you probably still are, you have a fiduciary responsibility to that organization. So if someone says we should do X, you're like, oh, that makes perfect sense. Then you go back to your company and they go, oh, we're not doing it. else. You're like, well, that's, I guess I can't change that. Like the fiduciary responsibility changes when you leave that room. And that is more challenging than the outside world probably realizes to kind of get everybody to agree and then agree again. It's a two-step agreement that has to happen.
100%, right? The people who have the individual fiduciary responsibility are individuals and they're representing companies who have their own fiduciary responsibilities. There's a lot of complexity in getting that multi-stakeholder alignment, something that you and I have worked on for many years in different contexts. So definitely
That's right.
appreciate that. Before we run out of time, I want to talk briefly about the policy stack sort of framework. I see a couple of different layers here. There's the federal foundation layer, if you will, right? There's the things like 21st Century Cures. There's the regulations connected to that. There's the framework around TEFCA. There's the enforcement for information blocking. There's the payment requirements from CMS. Then we have the standards and technical layer, which I think is the least important part, quite frankly, because it changes all the time and is varying different levels of adoption. Then there's sort of the network and governance layer, which you talked about, Paul, from Commonwealth side, and then also from the emerging TEFCA governance layer. Then there's implementation issues, market and business issues. What am I missing here in the full policy stack that drives this world?
Well, I think there is non-regulation federal drivers as well. I think like the CMS Aligned Network is this thing right now that people are trying to figure out where it fits, you know, and that's hearts and minds and vision versus actual thing, which accelerates. You know, I think a lot of this is about standard adoption curves, right? We're not done. I think, you know, what's the stat on number of hospitals that aren't interop connected? It's still, you know, it's a higher number than you would probably like it to be. A lot of the data is available. Like we don't have actual truths, but we'll talk about 90 to 97% of the data is available through interop. And that's probably true, right? And we haven't actually calculated it out, but the big hospitals are connected, you know, number of beds. You get down to rural health clinics and these little things, they're less likely to be connected. So we have a little bit of an equity problem in healthcare, and that, you know, there are areas and pockets that don't have connection, and they're the ones that actually need the interrupt the most, because when they get the specialty care, they have to leave their region. You know, we'll talk about healthcare being local to a blue in the face. It's no longer local when you have a specialty condition where you have to go leave your local community and get
That's
care
right.
someplace else. And so, you know, when you have to go to Boston Children's, but you're in rural Vermont, your data from Vermont better get over to Boston Children's, and hopefully not in a printed stack that you bring with you in a wheelbarrow. Like that's not helpful for anyone. So,
And there's no state HIE in Massachusetts anymore, and there is a state HIE in Vermont. So how are you going to bridge that gap?
well, exactly, and yeah, state lines also cause a whole nother gamut of problems. I used to have a lot of speeches on consent processes and all that back in the day. Fortunately, I don't do that much anymore. But I do think that the CMS line network thing in itself, you know, it's good to have. Now, is it creating exact technology stuff? No, but it is making people go faster
That's
to
right.
appease something, whether it's a vision or to make sure. Actually, I think it's not that far different from meaningful use days. You know, why did Commonwealth form? Commonwealth formed because Farzad, remember back in the day when he was running the ONC, said to the vendor community at a conference, start doing interop better before we tell you how to do it, right? And you're probably not going to like what we're going to tell you to do. So Commo formed right after that. It was like, good point. Let's do this ourselves before we're told how to do it the wrong way. And I think the CMS Aligned Network thing is kind of a reminder. It's like, we're still watching. Don't make
Exactly.
us make bad
Exactly. It's
regulation.
independent of administration. Ultimately, government regulators get to the same point. Organize yourself or we'll organize you. And we've seen this in almost every administration, interestingly.
The one thing I did want to say, because it's the only smart thing I can say that's relative to actual policy, and you can, you know, fact check this on me. The CMS Aligned Network, the most interesting thing there to me as a human being is the audit bullet, right? It says you should be able to see where your data has gone, because, and I'm enough of a HIPAA expert to do what I do, but I'm not a lawyer. My reading of HIPAA is your accounting of disclosures is limited to things that aren't already permitted by HIPAA, right? TP&O is not something you have to tell someone, right? And anything you've already consented to. So it brings up this question of, do you remember what you consented to? No, because there's no
No.
record of that. They hold it in some file that they can never seem to find. And then what the heck is TP&O, treatment payment operations? So right now, the law is I have to account for the disclosure effectively for a subpoena or a legal action that I was unaware of, right? So, a law enforcement exercise, and that's it. So, you talk about disclosing patients' data. I would seriously like to know where my data is going, because the idea of interop, even the treatment side, you're supposed to have a treatment relationship with that provider. And there are many providers I no longer feel I have a relationship with that are probably accessing my data. And I'd like to know where it's going. You talk about the B2B stuff that people don't know about. I think there's more that they don't know about than even know they don't know about. Like there's no knowns, unknown unknowns, and all that stuff. This is unknown unknown. And it's I think that's an interesting thing to add because it goes well beyond what HIPAA says to do.
Yeah, I totally agree. Well, Paul, it's been great having you on the policy stack, my fellow United Airlines road warrior, currently benched by your new puppy. I will see you out on the
One
road
K.
as soon as the puppy is potty trained. I'll see you back on United really soon, I'm sure. And thanks for joining today.
I appreciate it. Thank you.